Hello, and welcome to the Innovation Forum podcast for Friday, 22nd of February, with me, Ian Welsh. As usual, coming up is the news digest and information on what's coming up for us at Innovation Forum. And last week, I spoke with Ben Vreeburg from Bunge Lodders Crokland about sustainability in palm oil supply chains, commodity climate resilience, and what we need to look for in changing consumer patterns. It's a wide-ranging interview, and I hope well worth a listen. Next, though, is our regular review of what's happening in business and sustainability. For food companies, a big question has long been how to use technology and innovation to engage with complex supply chains to develop transparency, reward strong environmental and social performance, and ensure security of supply. Global food and beverage business Princes has perhaps shown how this can be done in a new partnership with Italian agriculture organisation Collodiretti, through which Princes will use blockchain to pay a premium to tomato farmers who use sensitive and sustainable techniques alongside robust measures to tackle worker rights and social issues. Suppliers will be encouraged to follow Princes' sustainability standards, including on water and other chemical inputs. With long-term contracts and access to grant funding, the rewards for those that do so. Blockchain platforms will become a requirement for Collodiretti farmers to enable transparency in the value chain and so that Princes can identify points of concern more quickly. This new innovation follows up on the 2018 milestone when Princes announced that all of its Italy-sourced tomatoes were accredited to the SAA 8000, Global GAP or GRASP accreditation. This has required 4,000 farm inspections and use of GPS mapping technology to trace the tomato crop. For many farmers, of course, adapting to a changing climate and maintaining yields while reducing inputs is the core challenge, and access to the latest seed technology is a crucial factor. A new study, Access to Seeds Index 2019, from the Access to Seeds Foundation in Amsterdam, has evaluated 13 global seed companies and concluded that millions of smallholder farmers are being excluded from the latest seed varieties. The index says that of the 500 million smallholder farmers worldwide that account for 80% of global food production, 90% of them can't access these new seed varieties. So while the seed companies are adapting their products to combat climate change and address the world's nutritional needs, to achieve this, they need to focus more on the 400 million plus potential smallholder customers that are currently missing out. The problem is particularly acute for farmers in Western and Central Africa, the Access to Seeds Index concludes, also citing the healthy profitability of the sole seed company that has actively engaged with smallholder farmers. New research from ZSL, the Zoological Society of London, highlights a lack of traceability for smallholder farmers in palm oil supply chains. Small farms account for 40% of global palm oil supply, but of the 58 companies on ZSL's spot assessment mechanism, only 15% publish maps of their smallholder supplier locations. Knowing where companies source from is critical, ZSL points out, for effective implementation of no deforestation programmes and for any degree of verification. Some better news this week on deforestation rates in Indonesia, with the announcement that tree cutting slowed sufficiently in 2017 to trigger payment from the Norwegian government under the terms of a 2010 deal to reduce emissions resulting from tree loss in Indonesia. The measures that the country brought in following the particularly bad fires in 2015 are thought to have contributed to the achievement. Elsewhere, debate is raging in the UK about recycling rates and the pros and cons of whether deposit return schemes are the answer to the question of how to improve the levels of take-back. The government is considering whether a mooted deposit scheme should include all drinks containers or only those of 750 millilitres or less. While there is no hard and fast line, typically environmental groups favour the all-in approach, while retailers prefer to go with only the smaller on-the-go containers. The British Retail Consortium says that the scheme should focus on cans and bottles consumed outside the home, and argues that including larger bottles than containers will undermine existing local government curbside collection schemes. Certainly, many of these rely on the value in PET bottles in particular for self-funding. Others argue that only through comprehensive incentive schemes such as deposit return can rates reach the 98% levels of recycling seen in countries including Germany. Another week and more research into why investors are taking corporate environmental, social and governance issues ever more seriously. In a new report, Are We Nearly There Yet?, professional services giant PwC suggests that the private equity industry now sees there to be a business case for responsible investment. 70% of private equity companies PwC surveyed have made public commitments to responsible investment, up from 59% in 2013, with an impressive 96% with or about to have responsible investment policies. Managing ESG issues has become a mainstream activity for teams involved in securing investment deals, being now viewed as one of the drivers of price. And finally this week, more circular economy news for the apparel sector. The UK Parliament's Environmental Audit Committee has issued a call for a one pence charge to be added to every garment produced to help fund development of more circular value chains for fast fashion in particular. 300,000 tonnes of clothing are sent to landfill or incineration in the UK alone each year. And the £35 million that the committee says could be raised by the one pence per garment charge would be used to develop better recycling facilities. Critics say that, while any such development is welcome, significantly more resources are required to break the current cradle-to-grave fast fashion business model. It's not that long until the start of Innovation Forum's spring conference season, and it's your last chance this week to save $300 on discounted passes for Innovation Forum's Future of Food event in Chicago on the 22nd and 23rd of May. Already joining us for a completely new and interactive conference are leading business figures from Kellogg, PepsiCo, Mars, Yum, Tyson, Mondelez, General Mills and Campbell Soup. Sign up by close on Friday 22nd to get the discount, and I hope to see you there. Our winter webinar series is in full swing. Well over 1,000 have been part of our two recent live discussions on supply chain data analysis and procurement modern slavery risks. And there's still time to sign up for our next free webinar, where I'll be talking about what big agribusinesses are doing to reduce greenhouse gas emissions with Kellogg, Margs and Campbell Soup on Thursday 28th of February at 4 p.m. in the UK and 11 a.m. East Coast. Links to sign up are on innovationforum.co.uk and in this week's newsletter. Coming up now is Ben Vreeburg, Director of Sustainability at Bunge Loders Crooklyn. He and I spoke last week about the future for palm oil supply, working with farmers to develop resilience, and the changing values consumers need to think about when making their retail choices. Ben, why don't you start off by giving us a bit of background to your business, what you do, who you work with, and where you are in the, particularly in the palm oil industry?
All right. Well, as you said, I work for Bunge/Bunge Loders Crooklyn, and I look after the sustainability aspects of the tropical oils that we source. Bunge, the large oils and grain trader processor, we source palm, soy, sun, canola, wheat, and we process that for our customers further downstream. And we have a global presence with operation facilities across the globe in all the continents, so we're able to serve our customers efficiently.
Well, thank you very much for that. We're going to talk today specifically about your palm oil business. In terms of thinking about your palm oil, in terms of transparency, a big thing, of course, for many commodity supply chains. But in palm oil, you've achieved 93% transparency to the mill for your palm oil supply chain. So what's been the principal challenges of getting to that level? What are the barriers to getting to 100% traceability?
Well, I think we are a bit higher than the 93. We're probably at 96, 97. There are always a couple of shipments that report in late with the traceability number, so that why we sometimes lack the remaining 2, 3%. But we have full visibility on where we source our oil from back to mill level. It used to be a big challenge 4 or 5 years ago when everybody was very scared to disclose mill information. These days, I think any company that sources palm oil has their own mill list published online. Quite a big administrative exercise. Not always sure what sort of value that adds if downstream retailers publish a mill list of 1,000 mills. But anyway, that's the way it goes, and transparency is there. The next challenge, obviously, is to move one step further upstream to the plantations. And that will be a challenge. And we also have to rethink if we want to end up with endless lists of plantations and coordinates, including smallholders, or there are other ways to do it much more efficient, while at the same time addressing the concerns of our stakeholders in terms of where the oil is coming from and how it's been verified to be compliant to the policies that we all have.
So what you're seeing then is that the levels of transparency in supply chains have been an industry-wide move then?
It is. And I've always wondered why it took us together so long to come with a universal mill list that is now available through OOTS and Global Forest Watch, because we're all sourcing from the same set of mills at some point.
big changes at the Roundtable for Sustainable Palm Oil in their revised principles and criteria at the end of last year. A lot of attention. How are they being implemented in practice so far?
A bit early to say, because the principle and criteria first had to be accepted, which happened at the General Assembly in November last year in Kota Kinabalu. That was obviously a great achievement. The next step is to get all the certification bodies trained in how to verify, and also the plantation companies, to review the principles and criteria and implement these on their plantations. Fortunately, many plantation companies have already made commitments and implemented commitments that were beyond the old RCOP&C. So there are several companies that shouldn't have too much difficulty in implementing the new ones. But in terms of having the oil available on the market, that's too early. It will probably take 6 to 12 months from the day that the principles and criteria were accepted.
How far were the new principles and criteria, in your view, the RSPO catching up? And how much are they actually taking the industry forward?
I think in terms of commitments of the big grower companies and the big brands, you could say they're catching up. But I think they're all converting now towards the same set of principles and criteria. And it's good that the RSPO is doing that. While at the same time, there's still a large volume of oil that is not yet even certified by the old principles and criteria. So there's always a risk of RSPO running too far ahead of the pack and losing a lot of potential RSPO members and oil that could be certified. But the standard that they have now accepted, I think, and you can always argue about some elements, and I know some stakeholders will argue about the credibility again, but the set of criteria that has been developed and accepted is well at par with the market expectations. I think the challenge is now that the market accepts these and starts buying these wholeheartedly in all their operations across the globe.
How far do you feel that the RSPO changes reflect an industry-wide desire to develop properly sustainable supply chains? I mean, do you think that there's been a bit of a game change in terms of everybody moving in that direction?
I'm not sure if it's a game changer, because I think the game has already changed. But it's the only system available that has specifically laid out principles and criteria, has set up a certification system and body and organization behind it that is able to do independent verification. And yes, you can continue to question the credibility of that, but there is no other system out there. Even individual companies lack resources and independency to verify their own volumes that they source. We all need independent verification bodies, and this is all in place. So I think the real game changer would be that the market now sort of convenes back to RSPO and accept that as the standard and as the system, because what I see is that individual companies or sets of companies are developing similar systems and similar processes, and it's all there. So rather than criticizing one, we could also use all that energy to build on that one system that is now out there and that has accepted principles and criteria that are with market expectations.
Are there elements of reinventing the wheel then, when people could just use the RSPO's principles and criteria, but in fact are developing similar separate systems?
I think so. And because ultimately, the people I talk to want independent verification. Well, that is available within the RSPO setting. They want an NDPE supply chain. And with the new principles and criteria, these elements are covered. So it's all out there. And I've been in the palm business for quite a while, but on the sustainability side for the last 5 years. And I've seen lots of arguments and fights and challenges and campaigns. I think it's time now to get behind the system and make it work, rather than trying to reinvent the wheel and all do our individual or group-wise new inventions that ultimately end up in the same place.
Do you think that the RSPO is best seen, or RSPO certification best seen, as a sort of stepping stone on the way to best practice, or is it now the kind of gold standard?
I don't think it's the gold standard. I have a sign behind my desk that says we are on a journey, and as we move forward, we will come to new insights and have new challenges. So any system will be a stepping stone, but it would be very helpful if we would all step on that stone rather than trying to avoid that step.
In the past, RSPO was heavily criticized for not properly implementing its previous standards. What evidence are you seeing that the new ones are going to be enforced more effectively?
I think that is a fair criticism. RSPO is growing, and I think RSPO can do also a bit more in terms of professionalizing its organization or the partners that it works with, because the stakes are rather high. So it is important that RSPO grows with the stakeholder demands. Am I seeing evidence that it's moving in that direction? Yes, RPO is investing a lot in strengthening their organization, but I think that they can do more, as we can do more in implementing our policies. And that is key for other stakeholders to accept RPO as the stepping stone. And therefore, it doesn't work if you continue to campaign against RPO, but rather use that energy to support RPO and help RPO to become stronger.
Thinking more generally, how do you find the balance when you're dealing with your suppliers between suspending relationships, as I know you did last year, suspending relationships with your suppliers, or working with them to improve their own sustainability, their own impacts? How do you get that balance? It must be very difficult.
Well, we take the approach that we always want to work with our suppliers. And if we identify gaps or if we identify non-compliances, we always check and verify and allow our suppliers to comment on it and to stop what they're doing. That's explicitly stated in our policy that if we detect, for instance, deforestation, we require our suppliers to immediately cease that development. But if they don't, of course, then we have to move towards suspension, or if the supplier is unwilling to collaborate, then we have no alternative than to suspend that supplier. But often suppliers are collaborative. It requires a fair bit of discussion and meetings. But if the attitude is right and the willingness is there, then our preferred option is to work and support our suppliers towards compliance rather than suspension. But as you said, we've suspended some suppliers in the past. There were obvious reasons for that, but always based on fact-finding, verification, and allowing the supplier to commit. But if that's not there, or to stop, but if they don't, and we continue to see that, for instance, clearing happens without any assessments, it's a no-brainer.
Thinking in terms, then, of the future, what are the remaining challenges that you're seeing for the palm oil sector? What would be the next big step forwards?
I think the next big step is more the way we collaborate with all the stakeholders rather than trying to invent new principles and criteria or to raise the bar even further. It's more about implementing what we have committed ourselves to as a sector, but also how we collaborate. I think NGOs are pushing companies to change their business model, and I think businesses have to change their model. It shouldn't only be based on hard financial targets and incentives. There is much more non-financial value that is added in supply chains that should be discussed. And businesses are changing their models and are changing the way they operate. They are also concerned about the impact they're having upstream in the supply chain and the community. So there's a lot happening. But at the same time, I think NGOs should also change their business model. It's all too easy to campaign on individual companies for the sake of attracting funds or for making a point. And you will always find cases that are not good. But I think here it's more how to focus on the things that are going well, how to support systems or groups of companies that are trying to do the right things right and give positive attention rather than to continue to find the negatives and focus on that. So we all have a responsibility here, all stakeholders involved. And I think the challenge is if we can find that common ground and work collectively, we can move forward from challenge to challenge.
What about climate resilience? What sort of levels of concern do you have as a business and as a sector, but generally in terms of where palm oil will be grown in the future as you know, climate change takes hold?
That's a good question, a tough one to ask. There is a growing population that needs to be fed. And I think it's not just about zooming in on one commodity and how that commodity can become climate resilient, and they have to. It's also about consumer behavior and the way we consume things. We have to change our businesses, but we also have to change our consumption patterns. We cannot continue to consume the way we are. I think palm oil is too small to be the only one that can be responsible for the climate change.
Some retailers have been announcing banning palm oil in certain products and everything else. But in fact, that in itself has unintended consequences when palm oil is such an efficient oil to be used in so many different ways.
Absolutely.
Do you think that the climate resilience debate may in fact mean that palm oil loses a lot of the negative connotations?
I think it does, because if you as a supermarket ban palm oil, you're replacing the palm oil with other oils that require much more land to produce the same amount of oil. You cannot single out one component, and another element is the value you add on it. If we are so concerned about the forests in Indonesia and in Brazil, then it's about time we put some value on it and work out mechanisms that has to be at government level, whether we like it or not, to preserve and conserve those forests that are the lungs of the earth and find other ways for those countries to develop their economy or their communities and keep the forest standing. I think we need to put much more emphasis on that rather than, and I come back on that, singling out a commodity and criticize it for things that is also taking place in other commodities. And that has to change. And that is something that stakeholders need to address as well.
Like so many things, when you're talking about resilience to climate change and developing more sustainable supply chains, it's always a bit more complicated than you think. Every time you uncover the one layer, there's always more complications underneath.
And to that point, Ian, and I can go on this a fair bit, but in 1960, an average Dutchman would spend 40% of his net income on food. Today, it's 11%. So we got 90% of our net income to spend on other things that are equally unsustainable or probably even more unsustainable. And you cannot deny that. You cannot talk about improving the sustainability of a commodity without talking about the value that sustainable practices have for people.
So it's much broader. It has to be an all-encompassing, holistic approach.
I mean,
push these things.
I've been on the sales side, and I've had many discussions with customers about the sustainable practices, but also on pricing. When you go to supermarkets, when you put on your television, it's all about the lowest price this, or if you can get it cheaper elsewhere, we'll pay it back. It's never about the other values that contributed to products. And that has to change, because if that doesn't change, it will be an uphill battle.
So perhaps that is the final remaining challenge, not just for the palm oil sector, but beyond, is really developing better value chains that value everything appropriately rather than just valuing some things and not others.
Exactly.
Ben Vreeburg from Bunge Lugars Copeland, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ian.
A reminder that it's the last chance this week to save up to $300 on passes to Innovation Forum's Future of Food Conference in Chicago this May. And don't forget to sign up for next week's webinar on emissions reductions in agriculture with Cabell Soup, Kellogg and Mars. But that's it for now. I've been Ian Welsh, and I'll be back next week.